Alrighty, folks, we are live. Let's see if it's pushing to all the socials. It looks like it should be posting the Zap.stream. It's always interesting to see if the streaming works out. It is hard to do a live stream from a typewriter. Alright. We're live on Zap.stream, but the stream is named incorrectly. It's named Test. That's kind of annoying. This is not a test, folks. This is the real deal. We're live today with Zach Shapiro and Frank Korva, two fine folks that have been very involved with the Samurai Wallet case. They are going to be participating in our event in Vegas, the Satirize the System event. It is the premier event to go to in Vegas. I personally think it's the only reason to be in Vegas. But I'm excited to have you guys here talk about what's going on with the Samurai Wallet case right now. Right now, the folks that we pay taxes to tell us where we can't smoke are really screwing with these guys. And they have some reasons why they're screwing with them, but they don't really seem like very legitimate reasons. So,
well, first of all, I just wanted, before we get into this, I want to congratulate Frank. Frank just got his credentials. Do you want to talk about that, Frank? This is a huge day. This is like, I am experiencing incredible FOMO right now.
Yeah, I'm here at, here in the train station, or Union Station in D.C. You know, it's an exciting day. We all love credentials in this space. We know how important credentials are. I know how much you guys appreciate them. So it's exciting
to
announce.
We value them. Yeah.
We value them. That's right. But yeah, we have a Bitcoiner in the White House. So we have a Bitcoin magazine got its hard pass to the White House today. They've been helping us out with soft passes to certain events. But I'll be reporting from there more frequently now, speaking with members of the admin and cabinet in depth. It's comparable, similar to what I just did with Secretary Lutnick and Bo Hines, who has the longest title in the history of government titles, maybe titles anywhere. But yeah, exciting days. Here's to credentials.
Are you excited to hang out with Caroline Leavitt? She's pretty hot.
She's a good looking lady. Yes, I've seen her around a few times that I've been here. Excited to definitely maybe smoke cigarettes with her. We'll see what happens.
Is David Bailey going to allow her to go to the White House and call her retarded? Let Shinobi go to the White House and call her retarded?
Oh, didn't you guys just publish something about how Shinobi is sexist? He doesn't call women retarded.
Yeah,
only calls them. Yeah.
Only if they're Republican.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Shinobi likes the lefties. He won't call the leftist women retarded. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, Shinobi's long been all in on DEI, so that's not.
He was like a hipster. He was into DEI before they even called it DEI, I think.
He was a first adopter, early mover.
Got into DEI before he got into Bitcoin.
Now he's bringing his DEI to the mempool. He's polluted it with DEI everywhere.
Does the White House, are you allowed to smoke in the White House? Do they have a smoking section or like a smoke pit on the property that you can hang out with, talk Bitcoin podcasts with, White House members and employees?
This is, I haven't seen it yet, but it's something worth bringing up if they don't have it. So I think they seem pretty receptive to whatever we've suggested thus far. So I think we could probably get something like this accomplished if it doesn't exist already.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have been concerned about RFK being a LARP, and this kind of like his moment to prove himself in the Make America Healthy Again agenda. Will he promote smoking or not? Is he actually the real deal, or is he just a LARP like Jack Cruz? You know, he's been going around calling all these people out for being kind of pretend Make America Healthy people.
Would you have to recommend what, like, that we all smoke American spirits, like cigarettes that don't have any sort of additives or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I think a good one would be repealing all the BS FDA requirements on what they put in cigarettes, but I think just promoting the smoking of cigarettes in general would be good. Like, you know, a lot of people like to talk about the mental health crisis, but nobody really likes to actually present any real solutions to it. And we all know that mental health issues would be completely eliminated like tomorrow in America if smoking was encouraged, reading Ayn Rand, listening to Bitcoin podcasts.
It's a winning formula. It's worked for at least you and I. I'm sure a lot of others would benefit. A lot of others out there would benefit from it as well.
Sounds like the formula for Mike Brock Kryptonite right there. You've got first, you've got RFK starts as a prized Democratic Brockian person, goes to the other side, pisses him off, and now you have him legalizing cigarettes, which Mike Brock still doesn't understand the health benefits of. I think that's just like a triple folded sandwich right there.
Hell yeah.
Luckily, I think he also wants to legalize MDMA, which will help with the overall mood.
That will definitely lift the vibes for sure. Now, before we get back into the CMRI stuff, just for a little more context. So Frank is now, he just got his White House credentials. He's going to be there reporting, doing journalism from ground zero. And Zach, you are orange pilling the politicians. And I'm curious about that experience. What has it been like so far during the Trump administration? Has it been receptive? And how are there enough politicians that haven't been orange pilled by Dennis Porter already for to keep you busy? Or do you have, or is this giving you more time for Bitcoin podcasts?
Look, I'm always appreciative of Dennis Porter's efforts at giving me more time for Bitcoin podcasts. But yeah, look, BPI's main mission is education in DC. And, you know, there's a big difference between being supportive and being educated. And so, you know, in that respect, there are other Bitcoin policy groups that I think are giving us more work. And so I don't think we're going to run out of politicians to have to explain Bitcoin and the nuances around non-custodial tools and good stuff like that too.
Well, what's it like when you thought you've educated an orange pill the politician, and then you go on the timeline and you see that they're pumping meme coins or they're into crypto or calling it digital assets? You're like, oh, we just went over this yesterday. We just went over this and you're already doing shit coins. Like, is that frustrating?
I think everyone needs to do that. And I really applaud at least they're going to speed run it, right? If everyone's going to come out a Bitcoin maximalist at the end, the fact that we've got a presidential meme coin and DeFi and, you know, I assume we're soon going to tokenize Middle Eastern jets. We're going to get to the end result sooner that way.
Interesting. Well, the average age of these politicians you're probably working with in orange pilling is like 85, you know? So like, what's this process of orange pilling them look like? You have to go meet them at Comet Ping Pong and then like teach them how to use their iPhone and like how to download an app from the App Store. Do you have to get their like grandchildren involved or what's that process look like?
Comet Pizza is no longer a safe space. So they're now mostly private dinner parties at John Podesta's house. And then we discuss, you know, what is Bitcoin? Why is it not a scam? Usually David Bailey has a lot to say at that point. And then, you know, it usually ends with them buying some amount of Shiba Inu. But again, we're speed running the process.
Very interesting.
Funny you bring up John Podesta. Sorry. Ties back into Samurai in that he was a part of the Clinton administration. And he was actually, before that, a lobbyist for corporate encryption. And then what does the Clinton cabinet do? They turn against Zimmerman and Daniel Bernstein. And it feels like we're just doing that all over again. And what do you know? There's John Podesta up there. Private dinner parties.
He's buying pizza with Monero.
Yeah. I mean, look, we are doing the Crypto Wars 2.0 with the Samurai Wallet and Tornado Cash cases. And so there's a lot of sort of fun 90s history we can bring back. And also the other thing John Podesta is known for is being a very serious advocate for UFO disclosure, which is now very much back in vogue, especially with our esteemed executive director at the Bitcoin Policy Institute.
So with the Samurai case, one of the problems, one of the issues is by the time this stuff hits the news, the media, the government, the federal prosecutors, they're able to set the narrative and like frame it, the conversation, in the kind of a terms that is allowed to be talked about. But something me and Richard really struggle with is, and we're just curious about your guys' thoughts, is from our first burns, just ethically, in a democracy, should it be illegal? Should you be punished for laundering money for the CIA? If we as a democratic society have voted for these politicians, support these policies, and they are using, they're pursuing their national security strategic objectives, the CIA, by laundering money, on the blockchain, and if Samurai is being accused of doing this, how is that even a crime? They are protecting democracy. They're helping the government. So why are they getting in trouble?
So I think there's a misunderstanding here about whether this is about fairness and the rule of law. If you're familiar with CIA history, they're very big into their rituals. There's some amount of human sacrifice that is just a necessary element in all of this. And the basic legal theory of the Samurai Wallet case is that we really wish there was a bank or some sort of financial institution you could hold responsible for people doing stuff we don't like with Bitcoin. That doesn't exist. And so essentially we need to find a human sacrifice. And so it's not really that so much that the developers did anything wrong from a legal perspective by offering the software. It's really more of a gentle offering to Moloch.
And I think one of the original charges was saying the quiet part out loud, which we knew the Samurai guys liked to do. That charge has since been dropped, so they needed to sort of press some other charges in light of them dropping that charge.
What are these charges? And like, what is the overall crime or wrongdoing that the government is prosecuting Samurai for? Like, it's not using mixers. It's not this. Like, what is it? Like, what does it boil down to?
There are two crimes that are alleged here. The first is conspiracy to commit money laundering, which really is saying the quiet part out loud. That is what they're being charged with. Specifically, the charge is you said stuff that makes it sound like you're insufficiently upset about people using your tools for nefarious purposes. And the defendants here, according to the government, did say some things about knowing that the gray or black market might use these tools. Never mind the fact that the gray or black market may totally well refer to situations like human rights advocates in Russia who need to be able to accept Bitcoin privately, or women in Afghanistan who can't get access to bank accounts and so are violating local laws by using Bitcoin through private transactions using coin joins. And then the other crime is unlicensed operation of a money transmission or money service business. And here the license would have been with a part of the government called FinCEN, a part of the Treasury Department, which has now come out and said that they would not have thought that this is money transmission. So there is sort of a Kafkaesque quality of you didn't get a license with someone who wasn't going to give you a license. And that's the other reason you go to prison. But those are the two charges.
But oddly I was going to add a little nuance to that, but oddly enough, it's the DOJ. The government has the right to say which FinCEN members are qualified to say these things and which don't. So in the most recent letter, you essentially had the government saying, well, these people at FinCEN weren't like the people we needed to be speaking with at FinCEN, which the people who would make the final decision on this at FinCEN, essentially, which is sort of ironic. It's like, well, why didn't you just call those people then? Why did you end up choosing these two people? And the other funny part there is like when you look at the titles for these two people, I forget them off the top of my head. Zach, you might know them, but they sounded like some pretty official titles, like the type of people you would call to get this sort of information.
Yeah, it was a policy person and an enforcement person who's generally the people at FinCEN who would know this. But there's been like several rounds of gaslighting. First, it's this is what FinCEN meant. And then it's it doesn't matter what FinCEN meant. And then it's we were just having a conversation with two of our pals and what they said doesn't really count. It looks like, based on what happened today in the Tornado Cash case, like the government is going to drop a specific subpart of one of the charges having to do specifically with FinCEN's characterization of coin joins, which is a meaningful step in the right direction. And so they're left with the other charge, which is the defendants knew that criminals would use the tool and they maintained a tool by which they transmitted funds. And it still runs into this problem of you're charging people with transmitting funds that they didn't transmit. We're slowly moving away from any kind of argument that FinCEN would have considered this to be something that needed a license.
Yeah, none of this stuff actually makes sense to anybody anyway. So like the crime doesn't even have to make sense. Like they don't have to actually have done what the government says they did, because none of this is real and nobody really understands it, especially not a judge or a jury, some 70 bunch year old. Right. So they can just be like a bunch, it's kind of like a mechanic talking to, a customer, not mechanic, the one from Ocean who is apparently, using a bunch of jargon to fool people, by the ones at like the auto mechanic. So they've got that on their side, and it's very difficult to gauge how much something matters based on how much the government spends in U.S. dollar terms, because that's just like so perverted now. Like you can't get any information from that buyer. You can tell by which credentials they throw at the case. Like who are the people? What credentials are they built upon here? Like they go to an Ivy League school. Is it this department, this attorney? Yeah. If they're throwing certain types of credentials, you can tell they are serious about winning for some reason.
Yeah, although you don't get to be an SDNY prosecutor unless you have those credentials. So this is the office that really, they decide that they are the smartest people in the room, and they famously take a very broad view of their jurisdiction. The problem is when it really gets to deep technical issues where for the first time in human history, we have electronic peer-to-peer transactions. And then it turns out having gone to Harvard Law School just isn't that helpful in figuring out how the Bank Secrecy Act applies.
Speaking of, let's not say credentials, but maybe experience. Zach, one of the things that doesn't get talked about too much was recently brought to my attention who this judge is, what other cases he has tried, what he's well known for. Am I mistaken? Have I heard wrong that this judge was actually the judge that tried the Epstein case? Am I wrong about this?
Oh, interesting. I actually don't know that.
I'm sure Whitney Webb said it on a podcast.
Yeah. Had to have been that. I think it was actually Shinobi, to be honest, out of all people that did this research and let me know. But, Shinobi, he might have been in like a fit of rage calling people retarded and just maybe blurted that out as well. I'm not sure.
Every once in a while, he gets one right.
Yeah, in 2019, judge ends a case against Epstein with a nod to the accusers. And the courthouse where this all happened is attached to the jail where Epstein definitely killed himself.
Let's just assume that's all a coincidence, because we can only speculate that that's all, let's assume it's all a coincidence. All right. We know that the judge tried Epstein. There's nothing weird. We know a lot of things. There's nothing we can do about it. But does that change the approach? Do you stop trying to use the moral high ground, or like this is what the Constitution said? Or do you start getting a little more creative with how you approach this? Because you're not going to win just because it's the technically like moral or legal thing to do. That's out the window. So does that change how you think about it?
Well, I want to put that one back on you. So we have the Blanche memo as well. For those who are not familiar with this, we had the U.S. Deputy Attorney General put out a memo in April, so at the beginning of April, I forget the date, maybe April 10th or something, in which he stated that this administration is no longer going to go after, mixers and other things related to what we call freedom check here. So it's a little bit interesting. It you know, it's part of me thinks like, is it some sort of, and I don't think this is the case, but you know, it's something that crossed my mind. Is it like, you know, was it conveniently sort of put out after the fact where maybe legal precedent could be established in the Samurai case and the Tornado Cash case? And then at the same time, it sort of looks like the administration's being friendly to people building this sort of technology by putting out this memo. But the big question seems to be, and it has come up in the correspondence between the prosecution, the defense, and the court, or the letters that that both sides have submitted, the Blanche memo has come up a lot, and especially the defense seems to think that that's grounds to throw out the money transmitter charges. I'm not sure if I have that exactly right, Zach, but I read the last letter they sent yesterday, and they do mention this specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they I think rightly view it as grounds to throw out the whole case, that this case is going after. The Blanche memo says, in addition to the specifics about these charges and mixers and tumblers, which, by the way, Samurai Wallet was not a mixer or a tumbler. I don't think we need to concede this ground to the government. It's a coin join. A mixer or a tumbler is a custodial tool, usually on the dark web, you know, where you try and buy weird marijuana that comes in brick form, but you don't want to use your KYC Coinbase wallet. And so you send it to a guy and he sends you other Bitcoin and then you use that. That's not what a coin join is. A coin join is a bunch of people spending Bitcoin at the same time. And what the Samurai Wallet devs created is a wallet that helps you find other people that want to participate in those collaborative transactions. So the Blanche memo talks about mixers and tumblers, but that's not what it was. But the Blanche memo specifically says we are not going to hold developers responsible for the acts of their users. And all of these charges, even beyond just the money transmission charges, are exactly about that. If you're saying that someone entered into a conspiracy to commit money laundering by offering a tool, and yes, maybe you did some unfortunate tweets in and around that tool, that is holding the developer responsible for the act of the user any way you slice it. And so that, I think, is the main relevance of the Blanche memo. It looks like we at least got an answer in Tornado Cash that the government has decided that their prosecution is going to move forward. They've officially decided it, notwithstanding the Blanche memo, and they just got rid of one of these minor slices here of the charges, and the rest of them are going forward to trial in July. But I think a more like the spirit of the Blanche memo, not even the spirit and the letter of the Blanche memo is that there shouldn't be these types of cases.
Zach, it feels like this is a trial already happening before the trial. It's this little back and forth of this should be thrown out. No, it shouldn't. How much is this actually, like how much weight do you actually give these to actually force the judge to decide against throwing the case out or forcing them to drop it, as opposed to how much is this just like maybe it's quote unquote normal pre-trial, like, you know, intimidation or something like that?
Could I add just one thing there quickly, if you don't mind? Just something from being in the courtroom for the four or five different pretrial hearings that have existed thus far. The prosecution in each of the hearings has, well, not the last one, but in the first three, was quite aggressive to the point where the judge actually had to say, like, okay, guys, enough, like, essentially save it for the trial. Like, you're getting ahead of yourselves by starting to make certain arguments. So just wanted to add that as context that thus far, the government has pushed pretty hard, and the judge has sort of told them to calm down in person.
Well, I actually think the judge has maybe more done that in the other direction. So it's not just wrangling or whatever. In the American legal system, judges decide issues of law, and juries decide issues of fact. And the most important part of all of this is the issue of law and not fact. It's does the Bank Secrecy Act somehow apply to peer-to-peer transactions where there's not a financial institution in the middle of a transaction? If we don't have a bank or a, you know, money transmission business or whatever that we can regulate, are we just going to punish the people who wrote the software that allow individuals to move their money around? And that is not a factual question. It is a factual question whether these statements that the Tornado Cash devs made on Twitter amount to a criminal money laundering conspiracy, and hopefully a jury will laugh that out of the room. But the legal threshold questions are super important. And you know, when Frank and I were last in the courtroom together, the defense counsel was trying to bring this to the judge's attention and say, hey, we're about to go through a bunch of really expensive discovery. There is this important threshold question of, does the Bank Secrecy Act apply here, regardless of whatever evidence the government does or does not have, regardless of all of the facts that the government is saying, let's say they're all true and a jury is going to find all those facts in favor of the government. Just as a legal matter, you can't bring these charges because of the way the Bank Secrecy Act works. And so before we spend all this time and money on discovery, let's figure this question out. And the judge was like, yeah, I don't want to deal with multiple motions here. So we're going to treat it all as one and save it for your omnibus, which means, you know, mash together motion later on. And then the judge basically just said that again with the revelation that the prosecutors came out with that they talked to FinCEN. The defense counsel said, we need to have a hearing so that the prosecutors can, you know, speak for why they didn't disclose this for a year and why they think it's appropriate to move forward with these charges, even once FinCEN said this wasn't money transmission. And again, the judge was like, yeah, let's save that for this same, you know, big motion that the defense is going to do at some point. I don't want to have a separate hearing on that.
Okay, just a quick question on that note, Zach, you actually mentioned, I think one of the motions is coming up in about a week and a half. Would that be what the judge was referring to? Essentially, like, if you guys want to talk about this, you could talk about it. And the pretrial motion that's they yes. pushed it back. It was initially scheduled for, yeah, the last Friday, but it'll be a week from this Friday, right?
Yeah, and it's going to be all the different motions. It's going to be the Brady motion. It's going to be the motion to dismiss, which is this legal question. It's going to be evidentiary motions to exclude things from the trial, what are called motions in limine. So all the legal questions that the judge needs to decide before this moves to a trial.
Very interesting. I mean, do you think it's reasonable that we should expect the judge to have to at least showcase that he listened to a few Bitcoin podcasts before being eligible to try this trial?
Well, Rule 16 of federal criminal procedure doesn't require that, but it does require him to have come to a firm conclusion on which side of the opportun debate he's on.
What do you think his stance on that is?
Look, this particular judge, I think, is a big runes guy. So
interesting.
I think generally his stance seems to be that he doesn't like a lot of this money, this arbitrary data. Well, you know, it's a different kind of arbitrary data in the opportun, but you know, he's not a big fan of arbitrary data just floating around there without KYC, AML, without a certain regulatory framework. So I would imagine that, he'd probably be okay with doing away with opportun, to be quite sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that is exciting about Bitcoin is that it lowers the price of money laundering. And it democratizes it. So it's not just like billionaires like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It opens it up to all of us. And that seems like one of the core battles here is, like, you know, the Southern District of New York believes that in order to be able to have access to money laundering, you need to be incredibly wealthy. You need to use the banking system. You need to be able to afford a lot of Jewish accountants.
I mean, we'll see where fees go.
What is the term for, like, when you submit, like, a letter or publish something to a court, not really in support, but you, like, want it to be on the record, so you're submitting it. Is there a term for that? You know what I'm talking about?
I think you're talking about an amicus brief.
Amicus brief. How do Bitcoiners and Bitcoin podcasters, how could we go about submitting an amicus brief that takes and coalesces some of the most important Bitcoin podcasts that have been, interviewed on the subject and transcribe those and send those as an amicus brief so that the court has to at least listen to, or, you know, read the transcripts of Saylor's series before, you know, continuing with this trial?
Yeah. Please don't.
I think that's actually only fair in that, I think it was the prosecution or the defense that mentioned the amount of terabytes of data that they have would, you could stack back and forth to the moon 22 times or something along those lines.
It would be a non-standard size amicus brief for sure.
Yeah.
But
it's funny in the, So early in my legal career, I did clerkships. I worked for federal judges actually in the same building where this is all going down. And one of the judges I worked for was an appellate judge on the Silk Road case. And one of the important parts of the appeal was, did they allow all the defense expert witness? And one of the defense expert witnesses was going to be Roger Ver, who wanted to go on stage and just explain the importance of Bitcoin to the jury for I don't know how long. And the judge found that that was not particularly relevant or helpful.
Yeah, that's what you got to love about Roger Ver. He just still does it for the love of the game, even if it's not necessary or helpful.
You'd think the Ross Ulbricht trial was not the time to do a live Bitcoin podcast. But
exactly. That's what the judge seemed to think. Maybe it was the time. Who knows? But I want to hear a little bit about P2P rights. So I learned about P2P rights in Nashville at the conference last year. I was talking to the Run and Dojo guys. They were explaining to me the whole situation that they were dealing with. That was the first time that I heard about it. I talked with some of the BPI guys there, smoked a cigarette with David Zell. It is a very interesting thing. You guys were able to identify that Jewish lawyers are expensive and that we need to help Bitcoiners afford them to get fair representation. So what is the P2P Rights Fund about? Why should people look at it? Why should people donate? I'm a donor to it. I've donated a fair amount of my podcast earnings to the fund.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me start by noting the irony. Neither of the principal defense lawyers in Samurai are Jewish lawyers, and the only Jewish lawyer deeply involved so far is myself, and I've not seen a dime. So I played myself in this one. But the P2P rights fund, it's explicitly not look, privacy is really important, but the P2P rights fund is not about privacy. It's about a very specific, really important issue that we're facing in this moment in time, which is that Satoshi Nakamoto in 2008 invented peer-to-peer electronic cash, right? And both the peer-to-peer part of it and the cash part mean that it is much more like handing a dollar bill, a physical paper bill from one person to another, than it is like sending a Venmo or Zelle transaction where you're using the traditional banking rails. And that is the innovation here. And certainly that's the innovation of Bitcoin as peer-to-peer money. And that's a lot of what the crypto people are working on with other things, sending JPEGs and tokens in a peer-to-peer fashion. And the law needs to digest the fact that this new technology exists. And until you've listened to hours and hours and hours of Bitcoin podcasts, it's kind of hard to fully grok what it means for money to be peer-to-peer. And we're doing a pretty decent job on Capitol Hill and in the White House educating people on why this is a big deal. But federal judges, just really fucking old. Like, they're just
right.
Very old. And there is a giant risk factor that we will get court cases, whether they are criminal court cases like the Samurai Wallet case or civil court cases. There are adjacent issues like with some of the decentralized exchanges in crypto land like Uniswap, where a judge might not understand that there isn't anyone to regulate in a peer-to-peer transaction. And the specific danger here is that we are going to criminalize the tools or criminalize the people who make the tools in place of a financial intermediary, which is presumed by the law but doesn't exist. So the Peer-to-Peer Rights Fund, we started it in April of 24, which was at the time of the indictment in the Samurai Wallet case, but also the same week as a reply brief in the Tornado Cash case, where the government put out this ridiculous argument that the word transmit doesn't require you to have control of something, but it can mean the same thing for like heat to be transmitted by a frying pan or electricity or data to be transmitted by a USB cable. And therefore they can punish anyone who is involved in facilitating any movement of money on the blockchain. And there's a real risk, as we've already seen once in the Tornado Cash cases, that judges are going to agree with this. So the reason for existence in the Peer-to-Peer Rights Fund, and I hope this is not a thing that lasts forever, it is to help this specific moment in time where we run a risk that courts, that judges are going to set bad case law because we have what's called a common law system in the United States where when judges decide something, that becomes law, that becomes precedent. We need to not accidentally have the precedent, not by regulators, not by elected officials, but just by judges who don't understand this technology, that don't get that this is peer-to-peer money. And so people, just like they have cash, have a right to transfer money peer-to-peer. The Bank Secrecy Act doesn't apply to it, and we need to keep it that way. And so the mission of the Peer-to-Peer Rights Fund and helping to fund the defense in the Samurai Wild case is the first big example of this. But unfortunately, there will be others down the road, is to get us through this difficult moment in time and to make sure that the case law that's going to be set over the next, I can't imagine this is longer than the next 5 years before the precedent gets solidified here, that the precedent comes out the right way and doesn't become sort of a accidental backdoor attack on freedom money.
Just a quick thing to weigh in on there, if you don't mind. I would say the one thing after speaking with Shores Provost, Bitcoin Core Dev, we did a talk at the MIT Freedom Tech Forum. I was, you know, for as ridiculous as some of what's coming out of the, you know, what's happened here around the Tornado Cash and Samurai Wallet cases has been, it's been even more ridiculous in the Netherlands, where I think it was the judge that ruled that just for deploying the smart contract where it could be used for money laundering, the person did something, or, you know, the developer did something that, you know, he knew could be used for illicit purposes and therefore, you know, did the wrong thing. I forget exactly what the judge said, but it's been even more harsh there. Thank goodness none of that will have any bearing on what gets decided here, but kind of insane to think that it can get more insane than it's been already here.
Yeah. It's that like vagueness around the word transmit and what it could mean. It's a reminder of the importance of understanding thermodynamics. And it almost makes me think, like, you should, in a case like this, you have a right to a jury that listens to 40 hours per week. Not just that, because that is what we're talking about, right? Peer to peer. That is a jury of your peers. Somebody who doesn't listen to Bitcoin podcasts. It's very hard to argue that they're my peer. But one of the things that the Bugle talked about almost all of 2024 was this, it boils down to this peer-to-peer rights. We have been doing all the, being transparent, we're showing proof of reserves, at Bitcoin exchanges. Swan has a proof of lawsuits to let everyone know any losses they're involved in. And we have, just say, people like Adam Semeca are holding Jack Dorsey accountable to show like his node and how many Bitcoin he has for his Bitcoin treasury company. And we've been doing all this and we've been complying and the government's just not, like, we talked about this, right? Like this brief came out that explained, like, hey, none of this stuff is illegal. And we're like, yeah, we're still not dropping the case. And it's like, we're giving it to an Epstein judge, more or less. Like, this person does not seem to understand the Constitution very well, but they're going to judge this case. And we're out, we're compliant so hard, the government's not compliant. How are we to have a peer-to-peer relationship with our democratically elected government if they are not holding up their end of the bargain? We're all complying, the government. It's time for them to comply.
Yeah, that's the end goal with all of this. The Peer-to-Peer Rights Fund is meant to bridge this moment in time and do our best to not get bad case law. But at the end of the day, the government is not going to like power being taken from them, power over the money supply, power to censor or surveil transactions. And so the government complied with regard to the Bitcoin network in the first place and didn't try and make an argument like the Bank Secrecy Act applies to Bitcoin itself, because that just wasn't possible, because someone out there figured out how to build a genuinely censorship resistant, even at the nation state level, so far, knock on wood, technology. And that's what we need. So David Zell and I are, we'll do our part. He'll, you know, he's up on the hill. I'm going to try and fight in these cases, but ultimately it comes down to the people who are building things, to people who are listening to their 40 hours per week of Bitcoin podcasts and saying, you know what? I think that I can raise some money from David Bailey to build something here.
Question to you about this whole like loss of power that might be a motivation behind this case. I was kind of wondering, if everybody's done their research and watched the show Billions, one of the main characters is like the lead attorney for SDNY. And I was wondering, like, why do they get to determine all these cases that have nothing to do with the Southern District of New York and have to do with the rest of the U.S.? And ChatGPT informed me about all these tiny little loopholes about how they're able to claim it goes through their jurisdiction, again, through their power. Things like, you know, if a wire just goes through New York, then they're able to claim that, prosecute there. If you have a headquarters there, it doesn't even need to go through New York. Apparently, that's another reason why SDNY can get the case. And then the most ridiculous one is just a server, if there's like a copy of it on the server or something like that. So how, I wonder, you brought up transmission and their definition of that. Is there any sort of like potential here where SDNY actually has like a personal motivation in this case, because it's maybe the start, they're losing ground if they lose this on what they can even prosecute against?
I mean, I think actually you just explained the, what's called a jurisdictional hook totally correctly. And it is every bit as ridiculous as you say. When they talk about money laundering conspiracy here, they need to talk about the underlying crime from which money laundering is happening to hide the funds. And they are picking wire fraud as one of those charges. That's not an accident. It's that the jurisdictional hook, as long as you get it going through computers in the jurisdiction, you can claim jurisdiction. The Southern District of New York has the most prestigious lawyers, right? Really, truly the most compliant of any U.S. Attorney's Office in the United States. And they try and bring these ambitious cases. You'd wish they'd be less ambitious in what they stretch the word transmission to mean, but this is actually completely par for the course. And that is a pretty realistic part of the show Billions.
Just a quick question for you too, Zach, there. How much do you feel like these lawyers really are trying to set an example by demonstrating their prowess and understanding the law and I don't know, you know, in fighting the bad guys and blah, 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 because they genuinely think it's right versus just egos being in the way and people wanting to prove certain points and that sort of muddying the waters as far as justice being served?
I think people are complicated and it's both. There's this really interesting book called The Chicken Shit Club about the prosecutor's office in the Southern District of New York right after the financial crisis. And this was the period that at least the first season of Billions is directly about, which was this big standoff between Preet Bharara, who was the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time. Actually, funny story about him. He sat down with Paul Giamatti to have lunch a whole bunch of times to prep for the role. And his very conservative Indian immigrant family was so excited that, you know, that he was going to be a character based on him at the show. And they all gathered for the premiere. And the first scene, if you've seen Billions, is like an S&M scene where Paul Giamatti gets peed on and a cigarette burned on his nipple or something like that. And Preet's parents were just livid and turned off the TV. And it was like a huge family scandal. Preet Bharara went after hedge fund managers for money laundering. That was what he did. He didn't go after any of the big public company CEOs, any of the big banks, any of the systemic things that led to the financial crisis, which happened right before his tenure there. And the book makes the case, the Chicken Shit Club, that all the lawyers there, they're smart, they want to go after bad guys, but then they also want to go make a couple million bucks a year at a big law firm. And going after these big law firms' biggest clients is not a great way to get that job, and you can only push so hard. And so I think people take... The people who go to the SDNY, people, they do it because they want trial experience. They do it because it's interesting. I think they do it because it's a sense of duty. But humans are humans. And ultimately, people are swayed by what they're personally motivated by. That's why Bitcoin works.
Yeah. I think there's two ways to approach this. Well, there's more than two ways, but there's two main ways to approach this. Either we support, or like you did, set up funds like p2prights.org. Or we need to petition Fauci to create another virus to kill all these boomer judges. And I think like the P2P rights is much more preferable than another boomer mover getting unleashed on society, because that wasn't very fun. Yeah, I mean, this is an important issue for all of us. As a Bitcoin podcaster, I take this very seriously. You know, one of the impacts that I've seen that's been very devastating by this case is many wallets and wallet developers have been afraid to work on the project. So in many ways, that invalidates a lot of the hard work that Bitcoin podcasters have done. You look at like a guy like BTC Sessions. He's done all these tutorials. The tutorials get invalidated retrospectively because these wallets don't support these jurisdictions anymore because of these court cases. And it's something that impacts us all. You know, like the guy that's going to the meetup every week, he onboarded the bartender to accept tips for using Wallace Satoshi. Well, now Wallace Satoshi doesn't work anymore. All that effort that and money that he spent teaching her how to use it, completely wasted. And that makes it very, very difficult to use and operate just, you know, teaching people about Bitcoin.
Could we be fair and say that if it weren't for the courts acting in the manner they're acting, then we wouldn't have the sort of grist for the mill for a podcast like this as well? So while they're sort of invalidating some of the podcasts that are made, they're giving us a reason to make other podcasts. So we want to be fair here in our assessment of the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I prefer not to do this podcast at the end of the day. You know what I mean?
It's like a duty you feel.
Well, I think it's important. I mean, it's just like, you know, at the Beagle, we believe strongly in not jumping on the engagement bandwagons just for the sake of engagement. I know that's kind of like an unusual thing in the replicator ecosystem. But like, you know, we believe in practicing journalism. We believe in, you know, talking about interesting things. I personally think this is one of the more interesting topics right now, unfortunately, one of the more important topics, and it's a little bit more important than people attempting to rape Luke Dash Jr.'s node. It definitely doesn't get as much engagement as that topic, but yeah, I do think it's important. I think it's important to like Rod was pointing out, we can't have this one-sided non-compliance where the government is the only one that has the right to not comply. That's wrong. We should either both be forced to comply, or we should be both allowed not to comply. But there needs to be equality of complying all around for everybody. And it's something I'm willing to, you know, put my foot down. We have this tagline, and you probably know about this, Frank, you know, being a credential journalism, like we believe very strongly that journalism dies in compliance. And in the very nature of Bitcoin at the end of the day, you know, is being not compliant. So, I mean, I think it's really good to bring the attack and just, you know, be on the offensive. Because that's like one of the problems is these guys they're always on the offensive. I think the average person using Bitcoin, they're just like, I want to do my peer-to-peer non-KYC cigarette transaction. I want to be left alone. I want to, you know, hang out, smoke my cigarettes, and listen to this podcast. I don't want to think about, you know, having to defend myself from the pedophiles who are trying to tell me not where I can't smoke. You know, I just want to enjoy, like, you know, I want to think about Dennis Porter and have sex with my wife. But the problem is these people are always on the offensive, trying to get in your way. They're trying to interrupt you. And whether you like it or not, they're going to show up eventually and tell you that custodial lightning transaction was not allowed.
You know, so I know you guys are pressed for time here. So I want to thank you for coming on. But I had one last question for Zach. If you guys didn't know, he was on What Bitcoin Did a few days ago. They got a really good episode. So check that out. But my question, Zach, when you, the day that you get to go on What Bitcoin Did, you get to do the What Bitcoin Did interview. And like when that comes out, you could share that in your group chat, send it to your family. Like, what's that like? That's got to be, let's go. I'm thinking about that day in my future, I hope. What was it like for you?
I think my family was very confused. No, I mean, look, Danny's terrific. I do feel bad. I briefly mixed up in the episode, Danny and Peter. And so I was trying to explain the common law point we were talking about earlier. I was like, you know, in the UK, this is the same system you have, forgetting that he was Australian. And so that was mortifying, but, it is the highest, possible credential in Bitcoin. And so, it's been difficult to see where I go from there. But
that's the worst part, right? It's like you think, dream about this day, and then you get there, it's like, I'm still not fulfilled. What's the next podcast? Maybe, I don't know. What kind of podcast do you listen to outside of Bitcoin?
I probably shouldn't say that out loud. It's
Fair enough. The political answer is, I don't listen to podcasts outside of Bitcoin.
No.
I don't have time.
I didn't know there were podcasts outside of Bitcoin.
Hell yeah, Frank. He gets it.
Might as well not be. Well, as we let you guys go, I think I'm going to keep the stream rolling and talk a little bit about the event after you guys drop off. But before we transition to that, you guys have anything you want to promote or say?
Yeah, really excited about your guys' event. And I think there is an important role to play if there ends up being a trial in Samurai Wallet. We're going to have to contextualize some of these statements defendants made. And so if the more we can make the case that was par for the course in Bitcoin lingo, the more helpful. So I hope and expect for some pretty outlandish stuff. And then for anyone looking for the polar opposite, I do want to shill the BPI very, very, very compliant summit at the end of June in DC. If you want to hang out with government officials, intelligence community folks, no joke, are going to come and speak about Bitcoin, and that's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I think just a second what Zach said there about the event, satirize the system. Everybody who will be in Vegas, if you haven't got your ticket yet, I believe it's Wednesday evening. That's the day, it's the evening after the second day of the conference. I will be the MC for the evening, for the earlier part of the evening, when we will have guests that are just trying to be compliant, the Caitlin Longs of the world, who are just trying to submit the proper paperwork and to get the proper, just trying to get the right documents so that she could none of the elders. I don't know if we would call Trace Mayer an elder. He is in sort of a different right, but he's not one of kind of quote unquote the elders, but still someone to be sort of very excited to have there. We'll have the one and only Rob Hamilton as well, from what I understand, an extremely extremely compliant individual. So yeah, looking forward to hosting it. Quite honored to be there with you. Hoping to smoke at least a full pack of cigarettes in between introducing introducing the different guests. So backstage, you guys see huge puffs of smoke coming out back. It's just Richard, Rod, and I, filling our lungs up with.
Where there is smoke, there is fire. Bitcoin podcast signal. And I would say I describe Trace Mayer as having a macro elder soul. He doesn't have the age, but he's got the macro elder soul.
Amen.
What brand of cigarettes do you smoke, Frank? Just out of curiosity.
Just as we know, there's only one type of podcast, the Bitcoin podcast. There's only one type of cigarette, and we know those are Marlboro Reds.
Well said. Very cool. Zach, you got anything?
No, looking forward to see you all there.
Hell yeah, man. Thanks for coming on.
Anytime.
Take it easy, guys.
See ya.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to roll for a minute. So update. If you want to pay for the event in Bitcoin, just DM the 21 Media. I think, it's pretty easy to do. Just hop in their DMs, shoot them DM. You can pay for Bitcoin.
I think there's some space here for like an event competitor. At this point, there's like one or two really good event companies slash sites. So we're using one of them, and it doesn't have any sort of Bitcoin acceptance. So I think there's room to compete with them. If there's anybody with any ideas for an event startup that just accepts Bitcoin, how many people would take that in a heartbeat?
I think you could probably do it with Zaprite. I've seen people do that before. That's a possibility. It probably needs to be marketed a little bit better, but yeah. I'm stoked for this event. I think it's going to be the best event in Vegas. We're going to make sure it's the best event in Vegas. We got a stellar group of individuals that already bought tickets. There definitely is the potential that we're running into that the VIP tickets will sell out because there's a limited amount of space in the wrestling room where Rod and I will be calling the fights. We have not hit that threshold yet, but you know, we're approaching it little slowly but surely. And yeah, I mean, I'm stoked about the event.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. The ticket sales, the VIP tickets, which long story short, as you mentioned, means you're in the live event room. I think it's almost at like a 1-to-1 ratio of the sales there. So that is kind of going fast. But on the upside of the other ticket is you have like the coolest, most fun venue where you get to play all the bowling you want. You get to play all the video games and stuff like that you want. You get to hang out at the bar and talk as much as you want with people around you. I guess you can do that at other places, but this is a place where it's going to be a full environment. Anywhere you turn, there's going to be some sort of activity to make your mitochondria go to work and give you some, I don't know, whatever the brain chemical is you get from serotonin for fun. Is that what it is? You guys are the credentialed experts here.
Probably dopamine.
Dopamine. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. And then actually we were just talking about Samurai Waltz. Let's talk about that again. Something that we all have cared about since before even knowing each other and crossed paths along the way, and was something that we wanted to carry forward together. So we are doing a trivia contest that is sponsored by the good people over at Zeus Wallet, where we'll play some Bitcoin trivia in the ring, go head to head, and each time you win, you get $100, and then you go on to become the champion. Somebody will be deemed the champion, and any of all of the money that goes towards the raffle tickets for being able to compete goes towards the Samurai Fund, the peer-to-peer fund. And then on top of that, every single ticket, $5 of it will be donated to the Samurai, the peer-to-peer fund. And and you get 5 tickets automatically. So just by showing up, you've donated money to the peer-to-peer fund and you've been entered in your chance to be a part of this contest. And then at that point, depending on how much you actually want to be in it, any sort of financial value that you put towards that all goes to the peer-to-peer fund. So that's something that I think is kind of cool. It can be hard to get people to donate. Sometimes, you know, you don't have much money. It's hard to do, but if you find yourself in Vegas and there's an entire event going on and some fun going on, maybe some friends going, the idea that you could, be also donating to Samurai Wallet is something that, that I guess makes it easier, makes it, something. I'm turning this in on myself because, there's times that you get stopped and people ask for donations and you want to help out, and maybe you've fallen on hard times or things like that. And it can be hard to do, but if you have put yourself in a situation where you are in Vegas, it means that you've already kind of committed, and this is an opportunity where you can not only donate just by going, but then, you know, donate just a little bit further while you're there. And And I think it'll be something that we can then get to talk about it, why it's important. We get some experts up there, some great people like we just had here. And it'll be all around a good time of not just talking the talk, but walking the walk.
Yeah, I just want to jump in here and say, you know, you have this, you know, this ask of the of donating. I'm of the opinion we've had a really good year. We're dunking on people left and right. Bitcoin 100K. I mean, if you've got MSCR, you're crushing it. If you got the MSTY, you quit your job, you're getting a bigger salary just collecting those dividends. Just give a month's MSTY dividends to the Samurai Thugs. You can afford it. You can afford your taxes. You're living it up right now. And it's only getting better. Bitcoin has already won. So, you know, let's make sure that the Samurai guys are in prison when we're out here winning. It's not fair.
I think it's more than that, though. I think it's like the Samurai guys are cool. I mean, I always found them annoying on Twitter before, and I think a lot of us did. But it's not about that. It's about one. It's two things. It's about actually being productive in holding these people that try and restrict our smoking rights accountable, and not allowing them to just like run over people. Like, you know, being annoying on Twitter is not a reason to go to Twitter, or sorry, go to prison. We shouldn't put
Shinobi in prison.
Shouldn't put Shinobi or Justin Batchelor or a lot of these guys in prison just because they're annoying in Twitter. And like, I think the reason why it's important we're doing this is we're trying to raise awareness around, one, a productive way to deal with these people. We're following the Scientologist playbook. They're the ones that really, really set the standard. What you do is you fund Jewish lawyers to go after these people and, muddle up their laws and eventually get them to submit. And they will submit eventually if you have enough energy behind it and noise. The reason why I support them, we're doing this, is because PodConf isn't. PodConf isn't supporting this or promoting it. You know, there's not a ton of engagement in supporting these guys. It is kind of a meme, like let's help the Samurai guys, you know, yada yada yada. I think like
at the end of the day, they'd rather hang out with hot politicians like Cynthia Lummis.
Yeah,
that's really what it ultimately boils down to. They want to go to the party. They want to hang out with hot politicians. They want to hang out with Ted Cruz. They want to hang out with the Trump's family, you know, his adult sons. And they want to talk about fucking shit coins and stable coins with politicians and Trump's adult sons. They don't want to talk about Samurai. They are ashamed of Samurai because Samurai are some of the biggest orange cells on Twitter. And probably at meetups, like it's when you go to a conference and there's like a dude dressed like a freaking ninja and like you can't even see his eyes. Like he's so, it's like you are an influencer. Somebody's going to know who you are just because, anyways, my point, that's an orange cell. But who's really bringing the most, who's really brought the most value or, just who's really been better for Bitcoin? It's definitely Samurai over a senator or a politician or, you know, Trump's adult sons.
Yeah.
It's like the family thing. I'm glad you brought it up, Greaser. I remember the, there was kind of like the, Wasabi, Samurai wars and the Samurai were definitely the dirtier and, let's just stick with that for the moment, side of that. And a lot of people dislike them because of that, but that's the kind of thing is, one day we can go from kind of hating on our dirty people that we see on Twitter to the next day, the government moves against them. And it's time for us to put up the fight and say, you can't do that to these people that we hate. There are people that we hate. And they have the right to be hated, and we're going to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, if we don't put our, our foot down and we say that, you know, just like let the annoying people on Twitter, you know, go to prison for stupid made up reasons just because we didn't like them because they were annoying on Twitter. We'll devolve into the UK. The next thing you know, people are getting put in jail for memes, and there really is a slippery slope with this stuff. Like, the reason why these people, you know, haven't already accomplished all of this stuff and being able to ban good memes, being able to ban good cultural things, it is not because they lack the guns to do it, but because people put their foot down in the sand and say, no, screw you, we're hiring Jewish lawyers and suing the shit out of you. And, you know, we're going to continue to do things this way anyways. And it's just like, it's cool to use Bitcoin. It's really cool to use Bitcoin. And yeah, there really is a future that we're looking at right now where we're
don't
not...
Don't judge all Bitcoiners by Joe Nakamoto, right? It's actually cool to use Bitcoin. It's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I'm not really satisfied with the only way of me being able to go and buy cigarettes being USDT in the future. That's not really what I'm rooting for, personally. I want to use Bitcoin to buy my cigarettes. And...
Yeah, I think it's a step towards the death of journalism. Free journalism is what it sounds like. Yeah. And you guys are the icons of that.
I wanted to add to this because I think there's one more camp, you know, that might just be skeptical of what we're doing here. And it's Samurai, they think Samurai are fed. So it's, you know, just because somebody's a fed, if they're a Bitcoiner, we're still going to help them as long as they're being charged with, you know, and something that's fundamental to us. Like, it's not that they're feds, it's not that they're annoying, it's that we don't want the precedent to be set that, like, doing a basic expressing a basic human fundamental right granted to you by God, the creator of the universe, whatever. And that's why I think we talked about this earlier, where we did with Zach and Frank, which was this stuff is so complicated and abstract that you get to in front of a jury or some boomer judge, they don't understand this stuff. They do not they don't follow. So these clever, that the government doesn't do very much well, but what they do well is they litigate and they prosecute in courts, especially criminal courts and financial crimes. So you've got very, very intelligent, very high IQ, high level operators. They are defining, they are using their law jargon memes to guide a judge or a jury who just, they're not going to think for themselves. None of these judges don't smoke cigarettes. And juries, a lot of them are NPCs. They a lot of them think like Mike Brock. But at least now I hope that thanks to Dennis Porter and all these bills that he's gotten passed in all these states, these people will have heard that it is your right to self-custody Bitcoin. It is your right to transact and run your own node. And it is your right to have a hardware wallet that you bought from a podcast. And maybe that will get through them, and it'll balance the scales of justice a little bit more, that everybody knows Dennis Porter has already fought for our right to own Bitcoin and to self-custody Bitcoin and to transact on chain. So maybe, you know, maybe we should, it's too early to be a doomer.
Totally.
Well, I think it's about, you know, whether we have permission to do these things or not, like, we have the moral right to do them at the end of the day. And, you know, when I look at things like this, when I look at people just getting dragged through the mud, like the Samurai guys are, with stupid charges that don't make any sense. When I look at that, I just think, what if that was me? You know, what if that was me a few years from now? And people just kind of twiddled their thumbs and didn't do anything about it. Like, I don't want to be one of those people that's just like twiddling my thumbs and not do anything about it. I want to be one of the people that would be taking care of me. Because there's a very real possibility, and I know this has happened to people that don't have as much meme power behind them, that didn't pay a bunch of designers to make, you know, cool branding that's easy to promote in the future, and have a catchy slogan, Free Samurai. Like that could be,
that is a cool slogan though.
It is a
Free cool Samurai. Mm-hmm. They definitely got that going for them.
The memes are cool. Look at Jeremy's shirt. That's a cool shirt.
I accidentally put this on today. I only realized it when I sat down and do the podcast.
Can you imagine Free Wasabi? That just sounds too goofy. Like, you know, you would take it serious. Nobody's going to put Free Wasabi in their Noster profile. If they did, somebody would just make a meme of like a sushi restaurant. I don't know. It would have worked. But Free Samurai, I mean, you put a Free Samurai like on an Ungovernable Misfits t-shirt, dude, that's selling out first hour. It's on there.
Yeah, Free Wasabi sounds like something a Japanese guy yells before he climaxes. That's not something that would do well.
I mean, it sounds hell like yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the sushi restaurants give out free wasabi anyways.
Yeah.
Like, people just think it's like some sort of marketing ploy to get people to eat more uncooked fish or something. Like, it's...
Instead of steak. Yeah.
I mean, the meme is good. So maybe that's something to think about. It's like, you know, maybe we should all be focusing on our brands and memes so that if and when we're put in jail, it's easier to raise money for our Jewish lawyer defense fund.
Yeah, the cypherpunks, you know, they're heralded for being these tech gurus who kind of stood up for free rights. And in some interviews, they said that it was actually the memes were the most effective. They would get together there and in Berkeley or wherever they were at and try and decide on what they should do. And it was the meme warfare that kind of won for them. And I wanted to bring up, you guys both kind of touched on like imagining yourself in these shoes and who's actually doing something about it. And we've kind of, the correlation has been made to the State versus Zimmerman 2.0. That's kind of like what the samurai case is. And something that Zimmerman said was that once the media realized that was a case about free speech, that was a case about code is speech, for them, obviously, they need speech. You guys know. You know the media needs speech. And they got all over. He said once they realized that, he had interviews every single day. Every single news station got in on it. They all started pushing the free speech narrative out into the public. They went over the public like overnight. And this is, I think, a similar thing, but because Bitcoin is harder to understand, there's now that mental barrier. I think Zach did a really good job painting that picture that for like this judge coming down to him having to figure out what Bitcoin is. And then you have Mechanic out there stomping all over the idea that Bitcoin is speech. There's a lot going against this at this moment, and all we need is that tipping point where we can finally, you know, have people realize this is a matter of speech and freedom and expression.
Thank God, Mechanic has a funny talker accent, because if like he had like a really confident masculine American accent and he was arguing this shit too, I think more seriously. But when he comes out of this, it's like, we're not taking any more advice from the funny talkers. We're done with advice from the funny talker. I hope that is, I hope that saves us.
Yeah, I do think, let's say the judge actually does decide to listen to a podcast. And right now you can't fall and miss a podcast with Mechanic in it. A good American judge, he's going to hear that accent and immediately just throw out everything that he's saying. So
it is. That is crazy. Like the UK government is banning and making memes illegal, and Mechanic is trying to make them illegal on chain. And it's like, why do British people hate memes so much? Why do they hate free speech so much? Why do they hate free? Why is he helping the English? Like, I mean, we all know what the royal family is all about. And what they like to do, over there, and the government there, they're even worse. And why is he? Why is he trying to ban memes and free speech? Why is he trying to help them?
It sounds like a case for the Bugle.
I think the easy answer to that is, America essentially got its independence from memes. They meme the British to death. And this is just like the overarching issue over and over again, is the incumbent typically isn't good at memeing. That's one of the advantages kind of the dissident groups have over the incumbent authoritarian in charge, is that they're because what makes a meme effective is having truth in it. If you spin a meme that is completely rooted in just like nonsense, it's not going to take off. It's not going to resonate with people, because even the most retarded, nicotine deficient NPC will resonate at least a little bit with the truth when they see it.
Right. Yeah, if you... Oh, right.
But yeah, I mean, if you're propagating like a meme, like
No, this is exactly what I was going to say. Is if you think on KYC cigarettes, if you think we're being silly, or like you think we're joking, we're not joking, right? Because if you think that's silly, the American Revolution started over non-KYCT. They burned it to the ground. They wanted not KYC caffeine in the morning. That's all they want. And they told the king to fuck off. They told the crown, the non-compliant state that they dealt with at the time, to tell them to fuck off. And they were willing to do it over non-KYC caffeine. Why? What do you mean you think we're joking? We shouldn't have KYC for cigarettes.
Well, here's why I buy my cigarettes non-KYC, because, I'm dissatisfied with the system. I don't consent to being told where I can and can't smoke. And so when you go and you do a KYC cigarette transaction, first of all, the gas station attendant sees your address, which is kind of weird. I think that's kind of weird. But second of all, what you're doing is they heap all these taxes on that cigarette transaction. So you're essentially paying taxes to the people who are telling you where you can't smoke, who are hanging out with figures like Epstein, whose images are being managed by people that are hanging out with Diddy. Like, why are you paying, why are you KYCing, why are you paying taxes on cigarettes? Like, for me, this is my act of the Boston Tea Party right here. This is the New York Cigarette Party.
There's an interesting backstory to that. I don't know if it extends beyond New York, but there was, let's say, an agreement where the taxes would go up so high on them that people would want non-KYC cigarettes, and those would be sold by the mafia to the vendors, who are then selling the non-KYC as a way to be cheaper. And they would either, steal them or buy them on the cheap and then sell them with a big markup and still be less than the taxed cigarettes.
Well, yeah, I don't believe in buying stolen products. I'm definitely not a fan on that. I've definitely vetted my cigarette dealers pretty thoroughly.
And if you buy it, like my parents, they buy bag tobacco and they roll their own cigarettes. So they don't have, like, they're basically, it's similar to mixers and tumblers. They're having just untraceable cigarettes, but they got fined for that. They got hit with a penalty. They can only buy the packs, 20 pack of Marlboros or whatever, no menthols, or, back when that was still banned. And it was just like so limited. Instead, like, they just wanted to save some money and roll their own cigarettes. Just wanted to do it sovereignly. They still took that away from them.
Yeah, we got to stand our ground on issues like this. But it's just like, if you believe that people should be thrown in jail because they don't want to pay taxes to people that have hung out on Epstein Island and tell them where not to smoke, I don't know what to say. There's got to be something wrong with you. Fundamentally, I don't know if you're drinking too much fluoride or you subscribed to Mike Brock's Substack for too long, or you know what's wrong with you if that's where you're coming from. Like I believe that there's a moral imperative to transact non-KYC with cigarettes. It is because the moral implications of submitting the KYC and paying the taxes are so atrocious. And I know people like to pretend like this stuff isn't real. People like to pretend like this stuff isn't real. And if that's the case, if you're an individual that's pretending like this stuff isn't real and it's not happening, you're a no-coiner.
I could tell you for a fact that it's real. My cousin had to spend 2 days in a county jail. It was either last summer or the summer before. There was a wildfire in Colorado, and he was hiking with his friends, and he got arrested for smoking a cigarette. It's like he's on state land he pays taxes for. And they're just like, oh, there's a fire nearby, so you're arrested for smoking a cigarette. It's like, you can't smoke a cigarette. If I'm not allowed to determine my own level of risk, I understand thermodynamics. I'm not going to start a fire. The government's starting fires with space lasers, and they're getting mad at me because I'm smoking a cigarette. Give me a break. Go after the real criminals.
Have you guys ever had it where you get a word that just gets completely destroyed? Anytime that you hear it, your mind just goes immediately to what?
It's autism.
So Greaser just said fundamentals, and I didn't hear another word that came out of his mouth because I just imagined, you know, here in Philly, fundamentals, who you have on every once in a while, the co-host of Rock Paper Bitcoin. I hear fundamentals, and I just immediately think of him. Like, I half expect him to come through the door, the smell of, you know, latkes coming in and Jewish curly hair immediately. But yeah, sorry, I heard fundamentals, and I just completely lost it.
He's going to be at the event. I'm excited.
Yeah, he's got a book coming out. Which is pretty great. Yeah. It's flying in the face of the idea of corporate treasuries. I really like that. His background as a something. It's not an accountant. I got schooled in this. It sounded like
actuary.
An accountant.
It's like an actuary. He managed. They have like a bunch of vice presidents at Vides Capital. It's one of those financial things in New York. They have a bunch of vice presidents. Big bank name, and he managed like hedged all the risk, so he's like, he's got credentials.
Yeah, that's one of those job positions, it sounds like, from medieval ages, like a cobbler or something like that. But it is really interesting. I can't wait for him to put this out there, because it really does fly in the face of all the popular talk that's going on in the podcasts right now. Look at this. Just got completely sidetracked because of one word. Thanks a lot, fundamentals.
Well, I think what you're highlighting
is a powerful impact to have.
You're highlighting there is the dangers of podcasts of the world, of the people trying to create a dogma, a mono narrative to completely control the conversation a certain way, not allow the free market of ideas to happen. Usually when people are restricting the free market of ideas, it's because they're propagating ideas that don't have merit, that don't have weight, in order to try and create some sort of agenda. And we see this all throughout history, you know, over and over again. And that's why it's important to have individuals that are willing to dissent from PodConf, to dissent from the mono narrative. They try and tell us that being this way is bad for NGU. that having other ideas other than what's PodConf approved is bad for NGE. That's their the rationale here. But I think there's an argument that that in many ways is good for NGE. You look at, you know, Ross is going to be free. He's going to be speaking at the conference. That's pretty cool. I mean, how many people have you talked to that have gotten into Bitcoin in one way or another because of the Silk Road? You look at like the Michael Jordan of Bitcoin podcasting, Peter McCormick. He got in because of the Silk Road.
The Pete Rose of podcasting.
Well,
yeah. Peter's a gambler. Yeah.
It's a good point, and he comes back around. These narratives get taken over. People with their value, these, you know, hedge fund guys that come in and they control the narrative of let's move Bitcoin this direction, and it gets sidetracked, and before you know it, you know, we're getting Washington DC credentials. Sorry, Frank. But this is a chance for us to put the focus back on. If you're in Vegas, it can actually be pretty cool. I'm imagining the old school Vegas, but here's an opportunity for all of us to get together and take a closer look at this NGU versus freedom money divergence that's going on. And then comedy, this came up earlier too. At film school, I was glad to have taken this class on comedy script writing, just purely for the historical value. He highlighted how comedy had like one purpose back in the day, and that was to criticize. That was the best and most, yeah, the best way to criticize whatever power was above you. And as you pointed out, you kind of have to get it. And if you're from, let's say, the lower class and you're being beaten on, and you understand this position, you have this perspective, it's possible to write comedy that speaks to you, that actually goes over the heads of the very people that you're criticizing. And so that's something that we're embracing. That's something I'm really happy to be able to have the right people there, have you guys there, and then pull in the other people who hear on that level with us, the freedom money level. And whether it's a conversation that's going on the stage, whether it's, you know, a midget throwing another midget out of the ring, and one of them happens to have the name of Michael Saylor while he's being thrown out of the ring, or whether it's a conversation that you're having, you know, in a different room, 100 feet away from that, just with some other people around you. It's an environment that I can't wait to be in and kick it with you guys.
So one thing I wanted to talk real quick. So Rod, you were working on this. You got Alex Brammer. He's coming to the event.
Yeah. We're going to have the live, you know, announcing with the midget wrestling. Alex is going to join us, and he's a Bitcoiner. He's like the pedicab guy, I think, for the videos. It's like on YouTube and maybe TikTok too. But he's also the guy that went to the Democratic National Convention. You got to see the guy first. He looks like he's a pretty fit guy. He doesn't look like a Democrat, really, like the type of male Democrat. But he's dressed like one. He's like just going through just like white dudes for Harris, you know, white dudes for like Terrence. There was him and Dennis Porter were on that crypto for Harris group. He was calling people out for not using pronouns. He was telling people his pronouns, and he was just like the most absurd satire of a you know, of a liberal. And like nobody at the DNC realized he was trolling them. It's like he was acting as ridiculous as possible, and they were just like going along with it. And it was pretty incredible. So who knows what he'll have in store for Satirize the System. But this dude trolled the entire Democratic National Convention and BBC News. So we'll see if he can troll the Bugle. I am skeptical that he's got what it takes to do that.
So he's going to be co-announcing with us. Sounds like the plan.
Yeah. So we're going to try and, each match is going to be a different point in Bitcoin history or a different dynamic of personalities that have, fought before. And we are going to try and rotate in some different people to join you on the announcing table, to maybe speak on it that might be relevant in some way, shape or form. But certainly it's also about the voice itself. And Alex is hilarious.
It almost makes me think like you could have, and this is just an idea, but considering how well he does his, he was able to pull the DNC. And so you get the Buell announcement stream, and then the what from the Bitcoin's history from the woke perspective, everybody's pro. It might be very important for some of these progressive Bitcoiners. They have a podcast to hear, the pronouns of the anonymous or the NIMS, back in 2011 on the message boards, Bitcoin talk forums. Because it's like, if you know that, what was the Cobra Bitcoin? Seems kind of like a datum to me. I don't know. It's people don't know that context. If they did, it could totally shape, the history of it. It'd be very interesting. And it would orange pill them. They would decide which Bitcoin core devs were in Gryffindor, which Bitcoin core devs were in Slytherin. And it's like, that's, Luke is a boy, whatever house you think Luke would be in for Harry Potter. And it's like, I think that's the stupidest thing ever, but that would orange pill my girlfriend, like learning about Luke and Peter Todd and their Harry Potter houses. So,
I think Luke's in Hufflepuff, but he thinks he's in Gryffindor.
I didn't want to go there, but because I'm not credentialed on the Harry Potter stuff, so I didn't want to go that one. But that's like, what do you think Moop's astrology sign is? Imagine if he's a Hufflepuff and like a Gemini. I don't know what that would mean, but I know that it would be really important to my girlfriend.
Do you know anybody that might be able to explain that?
She's going to be there. Aaron's going to be there.
Yeah,
Aaron's going to be there, and she's posting horoscopes on Bitcoin, 40 horoscopes a week, and she's hot. She does hang out with Casey Wordnals, so do with that what you will, but yeah.
Well, I have some headphones, noise-canceling headphones that I need to go pick up.
Time to recharge the headphones, boys. Time to recharge the headphones.
Yeah, it's for the trivia, actually, because we don't need people in the audience shouting out answers. If you're on stage competing, you're going to be wearing these headphones so that we can block that out. So I'm going to go pick those up right now. I've got the guy waiting for me.
That's a great way to end it. Yeah. Let's go recharge your head. Don't be afraid to take time to recharge your headphones. Everybody's got to recharge your headphones.
I do want to shout out before we end. I need to find her.
Both girls selling art.
Yeah. The girl selling art.
We've got a lot of girls coming to this party. I bet you some of these other side events could not say the same thing.
Yeah, give her a follow. Cheyenne, her user or profile name, Astral Aura. She signed on board to be selling her art at the event. Let me see if she's got it posted anywhere. Yeah, here we go. She's going to be doing these cool burnt out Bitcoin things. And
maybe she'd do a 40-hour per week one.
Ooh, that'd be cool. Yeah, here's a video of her doing it. It's pretty cool. I don't know if I could do that.
For all the audio people.
I always thought those things were used for lighting cigarettes. They're used for burning things in the woods.
So yeah, she's selling cigarette art.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Thermodynamic art. There's fire involved.
But yeah, bar miners could be running around with some bar jerky, selling that. If you're really interested in selling something at the event, that is like something that you made, you put work and time and effort into, that would be cool. Not really interested in financial products or, you know, whatever, but yeah. Anyways, I am stoked for the event. You can find, go follow D21 Media on Twitter. Their pinned post, the link to the event, Satirize the System, is pinned on their profile, D21 Media. Go check it out. If you want to hang out with us in Vegas, I'm going to be getting there about as early as I can. I think doors open at 7. I'm going to book it out right after the event. So if you want to hang out with me, show up on time. We'll get a chance to smoke cigarettes together. Trace Mayer, Caitlin Long, going to be there wearing cowboy hats. There's going to be an opportunity to go bowling. If you want to go bowling, I don't know if I'm going to have the opportunity to, because I'm going to probably be too busy talking to Bitcoin podcasters and Bitcoin podcast listeners. But we're going to have a really cool group of people. A lot of the attendees that have already bought their tickets are very, very interesting and cool people. I don't know if they want to necessarily publicize who all is going to the event, but it is definitely going to be a good use to your time. And yeah, I want to thank you everybody for tuning in to this stream. And if you want to donate to not just the Samurai Defense, but if you want to donate to the defense of people using Bitcoin peer-to-peer, go check out p2prights.org. That's what Zach Shapiro and BPI guys are up to. It's a really cool project I've been a fan of for a long time. Catch you soon. This route avoids a slowdown.